uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from coast to coast. So George W. Bush finally says, I'll take responsibility to the extent that the government failed. Did you see the clip of it on TV, though? If you didn't, if you have an opportunity to see it, and I'm not sure where that'll come. Actually, you can probably, my guess is, I may be wrong on this, but you never know, but my guess is that probably on the C-SPAN.org website, there is a clip of that. If not, perhaps on one of the news sites, perhaps one, you know, on CNN or whatever, but take a look on the web or, you know, watch the evening news, whatever, see if they play it. Take a look at that clip of George W. Bush saying that he takes responsibility. Now, first of all, he doesn't say exactly what he's taking responsibility for. I suppose we have to tip our hat to him at some level to say, you know, finally, he takes responsibility for something. But he starts out with this caveat, you know, to the extent that the government might have failed, quack. A lot of people are scratching their heads and saying why. Well, first, let me back up a little bit here. First of all, take a look at the clip and notice his eyes. When George W. Bush is speaking about something that is close to his heart, he is incredibly articulate. Mark Crispin Miller first pointed this out with his book, The Bush Dyslexicon, which is an absolutely shocking and stunning insight into the way George W. Bush's mind works. When he's speaking about something he really cares about, for example, killing people, if he's talking about the death penalty in Texas, if he's making jokes about Carla Faye Tucker, if he's talking about evildoers, if he's talking about wanted dead or alive, if he's talking about smoking them out, if he's talking about war, if he's talking about vengeance and punishment, which is the world in which he lives, he is brilliantly articulate. Look at yesterday when he was with the president of Iraq, Talabani, and he was Jamil Talabani is his name, I believe, and he was talking with him, and he started talking about Syria and Iran, and all of a sudden, you know, yes, these threats, and it's just flowing out of him, and he's very articulate when it has to do with the potential for violence, with anger, with vengeance. And I don't mean this as a slam on him. This is simply an observation. That's the world that he's comfortable with. I mean, it might have made him a great prosecuting attorney, for example. That's the world where he's comfortable. But when it comes to things like compassion, government having a role as we the people, protecting we the people, the protective capacity of government, he is completely fumbled, tongue-tied. He can't handle it. But interestingly, I mean, there's that contrast that Mark Crispin Miller pointed out, what, three years ago, I think, 4 years ago, when he first came out with his book, The Bush Dyslexicon, which is still a great read. There is that. But then it goes even a step further, and that is, if you watch the way that he behaved yesterday, when he said that, I take responsibility, his eyes were blinking so fast. It was as if somebody had a fan blowing, you know, one of those high-speed, you know, movie prop fans blowing at him, and somebody had just poured, you know, a bag full of live gnats into it, and they were flying at him or something. His eyes were just blinking away. Now, the only time I've seen that before, that really, really rapid eye blinking when somebody is owning up to something, is among abused children. I used to be the executive director of a residential treatment facility for abused kids in New Hampshire, the New England Salem Children's Village. And kids who had been slapped and beaten when they did wrong, whenever they were confronted with having done something wrong, they would go into this rapid eye blink, and sometimes they would even hold their hands up in front of them as if they were anticipating violence. It was like, you know, don't hit me. And you just have to wonder what kind of upbringing did this guy have. So I just tossed that out there. I'm not trying to play shrink to George W. Bush. Justin Frank, Dr. Frank, did a marvelous job of that with his book Bush on the Couch, and I refer you to that if you want to get into the psychoanalysis of Bush. But it's a fascinating observation. Now, the larger question, why did Bush do this? Why did he come along and say, okay, oops, I made a mistake? Why would he even acknowledge that? This is perhaps the larger question. And the question a lot of people are asking. And I think the answer is pretty straightforward. It wasn't just that his poll numbers were tanking, although that's what drove it. We know that the Bush White House is the most poll-driven White House in the history of the presidency. They are literally taking polls every day. Not only are they taking polls every day, but they have Frank Luntz and an army of folks out there focus grouping and testing virtually every phrase that comes out of this White House. Everything is run past a focus group before it's used, largely. Certainly all the major pronouncements. And I would be amazed if this hadn't been. So certainly that had something to do with it. But I think the larger picture is that this guy, President George W. Bush, is following the playbook of Ronald Reagan. After all, his presidency has been modeled after Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, they called him the Teflon president. He was very successful in even though his presidency had more senior officials indicted and convicted of major felonies than any administration in the history of the United States. If you use the metric of the number of officials convicted as your way of saying whether or not an administration is corrupt, Ronald Reagan ran the most corrupt administration in the history of the United States. And yet it never stuck to him. Why did it never stick? Number one, he never admitted he did wrong, with two exceptions. And number two, they always deflected the blame to somebody else. They always figured out a way to redirect the blame. They engaged in the big lie. You're seeing this email going around. Odds are you've gotten one from some right-wing friend or relative. I mean, I've literally gotten them from relatives of mine who are Republicans, and I've gotten them from people who have gotten them from relatives of theirs, and they seem to be coming out of the bowels of the RNC or one of the right-wing, saying, you know, President Bush had been begging Kathleen Blanco, the governor of Louisiana, to allow him to help even before the hurricane. I'm sorry, it was not true. I mean, there are these emails running around. The swift boating of Blanco and Nagin has begun, and it has begun big time. Big time. So anyhow, back to Reagan. The one time that Reagan, one of the two times that Reagan took responsibility, one was when he wanted to shut down the investigations into the possibility that he and Bush had cut a deal with the Ayatollah to hold the hostages to defeat Jimmy Carter. And he went on TV and he said, I don't remember having done anything wrong, but if we did, this administration did, I apologize for it, essentially. But the other is perhaps more interesting. And that was in 1983. When the suicide bombers with a truckload of explosives drove up to the Marine compound in Lebanon and blew the front of the building off, killing 200 and some odd U.S. Marines. An Al-Qaeda operation that we had had warnings about. And Reagan had been asleep at the switch. And not just Democrats, but Republicans as well, in Congress and in the press, were calling for an investigation. How did this happen? And how is he going to respond? Are we going to send troops into Lebanon? Are we going to take out Al-Qaeda? Are we going to do something about this Osama bin Laden guy? And Reagan wanted to put all of that to a stop. And so he went on TV and he said that he took full responsibility for the deaths of the soldiers in Lebanon. And within 3 days, all the discussion about an investigation was over. All the Republicans were saying, hey, why do you want an investigation? Reagan's already taken responsibility for it. We don't have to dig any deeper. It's over. And I'm of the opinion that that's what Bush was doing. And then also he could look at Janet Reno after the Waco disaster, which, by the way, was in progress. When George Herbert Walker Bush handed the presidency over to Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton inherited the Waco disaster. It had started the harassment of the Branch Davidians. So this started under the Bush administration. Janet Reno inherits this thing and handles it terribly. Kills a bunch of people. I mean, what? 75 bodies, 25 of them children. And Janet Reno goes out and she says that it is her responsibility. She said, I made the decision. I'm accountable. The buck stops with me. She said this on public, on national television. And what happens? Her popularity soars. I'm convinced that Bush's handlers in the White House looked back at Reagan and looked at what happened with Janet Reno and said, we've got to do the same thing. And Bush went out there and blinked his way through it, but did it. 17 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tell me, George, if there's any damn way that there'll ever be a day I can get on a plane.
Without worrying a bit.
Without worrying about the next maniac trying to pay me back just 'cause you're half insane.
Oh, no.
Right-wing freak judges, $200 billion grudges. Yes, war's cooked up right from day one. Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run.
Yeah, George, I hope you're having fun.
Yes, George, I hope you're having fun.
And arguably he's not, now that he's talking about taking responsibility. The question in my mind, and they asked this brilliantly over at the thinkprogress.org blog, is if he's going to accept responsibility. Now, some people are saying he said full responsibility. I listened to the clip again this morning. It's not, he's just saying responsibility. If he's going to accept responsibility for the blunders in managing the Katrina effort, how about responsibility for a few other things? By the way, Moondog in our chat room, you can drop into our chat room if you want. Live chat runs all the time. The program's on, and I've got the screen right in front of me here reading it. Moondog in the chat room points out that he's been reading on some of the right-wing blogs that it's all Michael Brown's fault. Now that Michael Brown has been fired, excuse me, he resigned. Yes. Right. Right. He resigned. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now that Michael Brown has resigned, the spin on the Reich wing is that Brown lied about his resume to George W. Bush, and therefore it's all Brown's fault. It's all Brown's fault. And that's going to be, you know, that's our story and we're sticking with it. I guarantee you Bush's talk tomorrow night is going to in some way imply that. And the whole Reich wing spin machine is out there. They are cranking this thing, pounding this thing so hard. Full responsibility. Well, I'm taking responsibility. I'm responsible. Yeah. How about taking responsibility, George, for pulling the weapons inspectors out of Iraq who were finding that there were no weapons of mass destruction and that the country represented no threat to us? How about taking responsibility for starting a preemptive, unnecessary war of choice against a country that represented no threat to the United States, that had no overt links to terrorism. I mean, the closest you can get is saying maybe there was one or two terrorists in the country. Yeah, like there aren't in Saudi Arabia. I don't think we're invading Saudi Arabia. How about Pakistan, where Osama bin Laden happens to be hanging out? We're not invading Pakistan. You got terrorists in Sri Lanka. You got terrorists in India. You got terrorists in the United States of America. They busted that guy down in Texas with enough explosives to take out the Oklahoma City Federal Building all over again. Oh, he was a white Christian. Therefore, it merited only about 2 inches in the newspaper. There's terrorists all over the world. Well, there were two terrorists there that we know of. And, of course, there was Saddam Hussein was giving $25,000 to every terrorist suicide bomber in Israel, which is a terrible, terrible thing. and a good reason for us to do something to stop that. But losing the lives of 2,000 Americans, taking limbs and eyes and you know, maiming 20,000 Americans, killing 100,000 Iraqi civilians, turning the entire world against us, I don't think that's the way to do it, George. Is he taking responsibility for that? No. Is he taking responsibility for approving interrogation techniques that, number one, don't produce good intelligence? But it sure feels good to punish those evildoers, doesn't it? Doesn't produce good intelligence. Number two, violates the Geneva Conventions, makes us the laughingstock and the scorn of the world. Number three, and perhaps most important, the torture of Abu Ghraib and the other interrogation techniques and operating concentration camps in Guantanamo Bay in violation of our own Constitution. The 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments of the Constitution. And putting our own soldiers at risk all around the world, should they ever be in a situation where they're endangered, he's not taking responsibility for that. Is he taking responsibility for lying to us about the cost of the Medicare prescription bill? The fact that they were putting into the bill a thing that the government couldn't negotiate with drug companies? They had to pay full retail, even though they're buying zillions of dollars worth of billions, literally, billions of dollars worth of stuff? No. Is he taking responsibility for the additional 6 million uninsured Americans since he became president? No. Is he taking responsibility for the 7% decline in the real value of the minimum wage since he became president? No. Is he taking responsibility for the 11% increase in poverty since he became president? No. Is he taking responsibility for the fact that for the last 4 straight years, median household incomes have not increased in the United States? No. How about the all-time high trade deficit, $700 billion? Is he taking responsibility for that? Or the multi-trillion dollar debt? No, he's not taking responsibility for any of that stuff. The polling isn't quite bad enough on that. Nobody's calling for investigations and inquiries into those things that he needs to put a stop to right away. Thank you very much. And then we get the story of Chertoff. I'll tell you about that right after this.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Yes, indeed. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com. The website, Knight Ridder reporting this afternoon, or this morning, or wherever you are, whatever time it is. The federal official with the power to mobilize a massive federal response to Hurricane Katrina was Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, not the former FEMA chief, Michael Brown, who was relieved of his duties and resigned earlier this week. Federal documents reviewed by Knight Ridder show. Even before the storm struck the Gulf Coast, Chertoff could have ordered federal agencies into action without any request from state or local officials. FEMA Chief Michael Brown had only limited authority to do so until about 36 hours after the storm hit, when Chertoff designated him the principal federal official in charge. As thousands of hurricane victims went without food, water, and shelter in the days after Katrina's early morning August 29 landfall, critics assailed Brown for being responsible, but Chertoff, not Brown, was in charge of managing the national response to a catastrophic disaster, according to the National Response Plan. This is the federal government's blueprint for how agencies handle natural disasters. Chertoff, a man, by the way, who holds dual citizenship in 2 different countries, one of them being the United States, Chertoff was the guy who, it turns out, was responsible. According to a memo obtained by Knight Ridder, Chertoff didn't shift that power to Brown until the late afternoon or evening of August 30th, 36 hours after Katrina hit Louisiana and Mississippi. I'm telling you, the swift boating of Blanco and Nagin has begun. You've got these emails going around in the blogosphere. You've got the RNC has their program callers out there, and they're calling talk show hosts all over the country, and if they think they're calling a liberal show, they'll say, you know, I don't really like George Bush, but, you know, it's, you know, the governor should be taking, you know, let's shift the blame as quickly as we can here. I mean, it's just, you know, George Bush was pleading with that governor to take aid. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Paul in Chicago on the line. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Well, he started to describe me, but I'm not one of those people. I do have to put some blame on the governor.
Why
didn't she call out the National Guard?
On Friday, August 26th, let's go through the timeline here, Paul. On Friday, August 26th, Friday, okay, this is 2 days before the hurricane hits, Kathleen Blanco declares a state of emergency in Louisiana. Now, keep in mind, first of all, half of her National Guard is in Iraq right now. Secondly, Gulf states, Coast states request troop assistance from the Pentagon. This is calling out the National Guard. At a 9-1 press conference, Lieutenant General Russell Honore, commander of the Joint Task Force Katrina, said that the Gulf states began the process. This is Governor Blanco, began the process of requesting additional forces on Friday, August 26th. This is the Department of Defense saying that she called for troops on the 26th of August. On the 27th of August, the next day, Saturday, the Republican governor of Mississippi, Haley Barbour, declares a state of emergency. At 5 a.m., Katrina is upgraded to a Category 3 hurricane. It's still offshore. Governor Blanco, we're talking Saturday, the 27th. Governor Blanco asks Bush to declare a federal state of emergency in Louisiana. She writes to the president, quote, I have determined that this incident is of such severity and magnitude that effective response is beyond the capabilities of the state and affected local governments, and that supplementary federal assistance is necessary to save lives, protect property, public health and safety, or to avert and lessen the threat of a disaster, end quote.
Well, that's good to hear. That
okay.
Let me
continue here. Federal emergency was declared. DHS and FEMA were given full authority to respond to Katrina. At that point, it was no longer in her hands. George Bush signed an order saying there's a federal authority. Quote, from the White House. This is, you can find this at whitehouse.gov, the White House website. Specifically, FEMA is authorized to identify, mobilize, and provide at its discretion equipment and resources necessary to alleviate the impacts of the emergency. Sunday, it still has not hit ground yet. Sunday, August 28th, 2 a.m., it's upgraded to a Category 4 hurricane. 7 a.m., it's upgraded to a Category 5. That morning, Louisiana newspapers, screaming headline, forecasters fear levees won't hold Katrina. Forecasters fear Sunday afternoon the storm will drive waters into New Orleans. 9:30 a.m., the mayor issues the first ever mandatory evacuation of New Orleans. Contrary to the right-wing spin email that's going around, Mayor Nagin issued a mandatory evacuation of New Orleans, 9:30 a.m., Sunday, August 28th, before the hurricane hit. He said, and I quote, we're facing the storm most of us have feared. This is going to be an unprecedented event, end quote. By the afternoon, Brown, Bush, and Chertoff were briefed by Dr. Max Mayfield, the director of the National Hurricane Center. He said, and I quote, I'm quoting Dr. Max Mayfield, the director of the National Hurricane Center, that he was on the telephone with George W. Bush, Michael Brown, and Michael Chertoff, and he said, quote, we were briefing them way before landfall. It's not like this was a surprise. We had in the advisories that the levees could be topped, end quote. 4:30 p.m. Central Daylight Time. Weather Service issues special hurricane. It still hasn't hit. In the event of a Category 4 or 5 hit, this is from the National Weather Service, most of the area will be uninhabitable for weeks, perhaps longer. At least one half of well-constructed homes will have roof and wall failure. All gabled roofs will fail, leaving those homes severely damaged or destroyed. Power outages will last for weeks. Water shortages will make human suffering incredible by modern standards. End quote. This is the weather advisory that the National Weather Service gave to the president, gave to Michael Chertoff, gave to Michael Brown. This is what the governor and the mayor were reading, and this is why a day before the governor and the mayor had said, help! Late that night, reports of water topping over the levee. The Times-Picayune reported, waves crashed atop the exercise path on Lake Pontchartrain Levee in Kenner early Monday as Katrina churned closer. It still hasn't hit. Approximately 30,000 evacuees gather at the Superdome with roughly 36 hours worth of food. Louisiana National Guard requests, which has already been mobilized by the governor 2 days earlier. Louisiana National Guard requests 700 buses from FEMA for evacuations. FEMA sends 100 buses. 7 a.m. Monday. Katrina makes landfall. We're now 3 days into this since Blanco has begged for help of George W. Bush. 7 a.m., 8 a.m., Mayor Nagin reports that water's flowing over the levee. I've gotten reports this morning that there's already water coming over one of the levee systems. He's on NBC's Today Show. The morning, Bush calls Secretary Chertoff, and what does he discuss with him?
What
got any idea?
Sports?
Immigration.
Exactly.
Here's an exact a verbatim quote from George W. Bush at a press conference.
Oh, he finally paid attention to immigration.
He's out there having a breakfast birthday party with John McCain eating cake, and he says, I spoke with Mike Chertoff today. He's the head of the Department of Homeland Security. I knew people would want me to discuss immigration with him, so we got us on an airplane, a telephone on Air Force One, so I called him, and I said, are you working with the governor about immigration? And he said, you bet we are. He's talking about the governor of Arizona. He's in Arizona to have cake with John McCain. An hour later, he's got a photo op with McCain. 11 a.m., Michael Brown finally requests the DHS dispatch 1,000 employees to the region, but says that they have 2 days to arrive. This is, you know, the Associated Press. Brown's memo to Chertoff described Katrina as, quote, this near-catastrophic event, but otherwise lacked any urgent language. The memo politely ended, thank you for your consideration in helping us meet our responsibilities, end quote. Late morning, the levee is breached. A large section of New Orleans is now underwater. What does George Bush do? He goes to a resort in Arizona to promote Medicare. And he holds a press conference and he says, this new bill I signed says if you're a senior and you like the way things are, you're in good shape, don't change. But by the way, there's a lot of different options here, and we're here to talk about what this means to our seniors. He's talking about Social Security and Medicare. While people on Social Security and Medicare are drowning in New Orleans. 4:30 p.m., Bush travels to California to a senior center to talk about Medicare and Social Security. 8 p.m., Rumsfeld attends the San Diego Padres baseball game. 8 p.m., Governor Blanco calls George Bush. Mr. President, we need your help. We need everything you've got. She says this publicly because she's been trying to call him on the phone all day, and he doesn't take her calls.
Wow.
Late that evening, we're talking Monday night now, Governor Blanco has tried to call him 4 times and hasn't gotten through. And what does he do? He goes to bed. 11 a.m. the next morning, Tuesday, you now have people dead, drowned in New Orleans. Bush speaks at the Iraq at the Naval Air Base in Coronado. Finally, midday, noon on Tuesday, Chertoff figures out that they got a problem. He says, this is what he said on Meet the Press. He said it was on Tuesday that the levee started to break. Now he's only 2 days off. And it was on midday Tuesday that I became aware of the fact that there was no possibility of plugging the gap. The Pentagon claims there are enough National Guard troops in the region. Pentagon spokesman Lawrence DeRita says the states have adequate National Guard units to handle the hurricane needs. Where were they 4 days earlier when the governor was begging for them? Now you've got looting. You've got people saying, we don't have food and water. We're going to go get it, in addition to the bad looting. And all this time, the U.S. baton, an 884-foot ship designed to dispatch Marines and amphibious assaults, helicopters, doctors, hospital beds, food and water, it can make 100,000 gallons of water a day, just happened to be in the Gulf of Mexico, sat there as Katrina went right over it. This is a ship that can handle a Category 5 hurricane, rode out the storm, followed the storm to shore, and was docked just miles off the coast of New Orleans. And here we are, 5 days later, helicopter pilots standing on its deck saying, when are we going to go in to take people out? Nothing.
Wow.
Nothing. The hospital's facilities, including 6 operating rooms and 600 beds for patients, empty. 2 p.m. 2 p.m. on Tuesday now. President Bush plays the guitar with country singer Mark Wills. He returns to Crawford that evening, and he goes to bed. Wednesday, August 31st, 1:45 a.m., the middle of the night, FEMA finally requests ambulances. 18 hours later, FEMA requests ambulances. Then they discover they don't have the ambulances, so they cancel the request. The National Guard troops arrive in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida from out of state 2 days after they've been requested because Chertoff and Brown said, you got 2 days to get there. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. That's just the beginning of the timeline. So, you know,
it should be rammed down his throat.
Here I am doing it.
I'm hearing about the 300 buses under the water and how Mayor sat on his ass.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. Those were school buses, and the drivers of those school buses were getting their butts out of town. And the reason that they weren't mobilized was because the governor had asked FEMA to send the buses down. FEMA said, no problem, we'll take care of it. We've got the right kind of buses to get these people out and a place to take them to. And the governor of Louisiana made the terrible mistake of trusting the president of the United States. Thanks for your call, Paul. I appreciate it.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends.
Working hard to make a living,
It is 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our chat room. Tony in Indiana on the line. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. You know, this is getting utterly ridiculous.
Sure.
For one, Blanco and the mayor should take full responsibility for not reacting 2 days before they knew the storm was going to hit.
Okay, now I'm looking right now at the governor's website. This is www.gov.state.la.us, the state of Louisiana official website. And I'm looking at a press release that was issued on the 26th of August. This is 3 days before the hurricane hit landfall. That says, and I quote to you, this is number proclamation number 48, KBB 2005. The Governor Kathleen Babineau Blanco today issued proclamation number 48, KBB 2005, declaring a state of emergency for the state of Louisiana as Hurricane Katrina poses an imminent threat, carrying severe storms, high winds, and torrential rain that may cause flooding and damage to private property and public facilities and threaten the safety and security of the citizens of Louisiana. It extends from August 26, 2005 through Sunday, September 25, 2005, unless terminated sooner. And then there's all this legal language, and then it says, Kathleen Babineau Blanco, governor of the state of Louisiana, by virtue of the authority vested by the Constitution, blah, blah, do hereby order and direct as follows. Section 1. Pursuant to the Louisiana Homeland Security Emergency Assistance Disaster Act, RS-29721, et sec., a state of emergency is declared to exist in the state of Louisiana as Hurricane Katrina poses an imminent threat, blah, blah, blah. Section 2. The state of Louisiana's Emergency Response and Recovery Program is activated. That activates the National Guard. Under the command of the director of the state Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness to prepare for and provide emergency support services. Section 3, the state of emergency extends from August 26th through September 25th. She did act. You have been listening to Republicans who have been lying to you.
No, I've been listening to both, and right now it makes no sense. With all these buses, she supposedly asked Bush for buses, or FEMA, to send buses down. They said they would. So she waits.
That's right.
2 days after the storm hits. To sit there and start blaming Bush for everything?
No, I'm sorry. It was not 2 days after the storm hit that she tried to that anybody was blaming Bush. It was as the storm was hit. The day before the storm hit, she called the White House and asked for assistance, and the president gave it to her. He declared a state of emergency.
2 days before the storm hit.
That's right. That's
okay,
when, so he declares it. He declares a state of emergency, and at that point, Michael Chertoff is supposed to be sending folks down there and getting stuff ready, the same way they did over and over and over again in Florida with every single hurricane that hit Jeb Bush's state.
Well, how come the mayor took off immediately for Dallas, Texas?
The mayor was in New Orleans through the whole thing. Didn't you hear his plea on radio? Again, you've been reading these lying emails that are flying around, Tony. I'm really sorry, but these people are lying to you. The mayor never left Louisiana. He never left New Orleans.
I don't sit there and see how anybody could sit there and blame George Bush for everything.
Yeah, well,
that's what the liberals are doing. They're blaming him for everything. This hurricane is sitting off the coast of Carolina now. Is that Bush's fault?
I am not blaming George Bush for the hurricane. What I'm saying, Tony, very clearly, and you can read it in Newsweek, in the new edition of Newsweek, is that George Bush didn't even realize until Thursday that this was happening because he doesn't read newspapers and he doesn't watch television. He is the bubble boy. He is purposely insulated. Four of his senior advisors had to get together and essentially draw straws to decide who was going to tell him the bad news. Finally, Dan Bartlett was the one who got stuck with the job. He made a DVD of all the news reports from the previous 3 days showing people drowning and took that to the president and showed it to him on Air Force One on Thursday as he was flying down there for his flyover of Louisiana. That's when Bush realized what was going on, because he lives in a bubble, because he is so completely isolated, because he is such a tyrant to his employees that they are terrified of him. They're afraid that he's going to bite their heads off if they say the wrong thing to him. In fact, in the Newsweek article, they talk about one aide at one point had to bring him bad news and afterwards had the dry heaves. He was so terrified because this president goes into rages when people contradict him. 1-866-889-8894. Jerry in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jerry.
Hi, Tom. Today's my birthday, and it's been made extra special by being able to talk to you.
Well, happy birthday, Jerry.
I want you to know that you're my new hero. I just started listening to you since you've become a part of Sirius Satellite Radio.
Well, thank you.
My comment, first of all...
If you're in Pittsburgh, I'm also on WPTT there.
Okay, yeah, that's correct, but I never heard you there.
Okay.
the previous caller sounds like maybe he's coming from one of those boiler rooms in Virginia that you've told us about.
Could be, or it could be, you know, I'm willing to assume that he's actually, that there are a lot of well-intentioned people who are just getting these swift boat, the swift boat operation is underway. It is absolutely underway. And, you know, I was kind of lightheartedly over the last couple of days saying, I bet you, you know, I've got this bet with Heidi Tauber, who does the morning show with me here in Portland, that within 30 days, which is now down to about 25 days, that public opinion will have swung the other way and people will not believe their lying eyes. Right? They're going to believe that Blanco and Nagin were responsible for the failure of response when what did they have? Blanco has a National Guard with 6,000 troops. 3,000 of them are in Iraq. They took all the amphibious vehicles with them. They took all the electric generators with them. What's she supposed to do with 3,000 troops? Come on. This is why we have FEMA. This is why you have a federal government. And it worked very, very well in Florida. For every, I mean, even the possibility of a earthquake or hurricane, they're down there. They're passing out goodies and things. I mean, it's just absolutely off the top. Thanks a lot for the call and happy birthday, Jerry. Larry, I just have a few seconds. A quick comment.
Yeah, Tom, just a quick comment. The thing that blatantly stands out still in my mind is the day that Bush finally went to Louisiana, 1 hour prior, what arrived, all the aid with the amphibious vehicles from going to the Superdome.
That's right, And he's doing a photo op in front of a landed helicopter because while he was there, he would not allow the helicopters to provide aid or rescue people because he was afraid that somebody might take a helicopter and try and crash it into him or something.
There you go.
And now he's going back down there to screw things up again.
Yeah.
It's all about PR. It's all about salvaging his political butt. And it's a tragedy for the United States, truly a tragedy. Larry, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. What do we do about this? What we do about this is you get politically active. We need to have an adversarial political system in this country again. We need the Democrats in control of the House and Senate.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Alec DeBrow is with us. Alec is the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCA.org, an organization that is, shall we say, affiliated with the AFL-CIO?
Yeah, we'll say it. It's ilcaonline.org.
Thank you.
Yes, we are most certainly affiliated with them, and we represent labor.
Alec, explain to us how the Davis-Bacon Act of 1931 came to be. Why was it passed in the first place?
Well,
let me just set this up for a second, if you don't mind. George Bush, was it yesterday? It was the day before yesterday, I believe. By executive order, suspended the Davis-Bacon Act in those areas in Mississippi and Louisiana and Alabama where there is big storm damage from Katrina. He suspended the Davis-Bacon Act. The Davis-Bacon Act says that if federal money is coming into an area to do pretty much anything, it has to be done. They have to pay the prevailing wage. In other words, they can't be a destabilizing influence on wages in an area. So it was passed in 1931 in the depths of the Depression, and Herbert Hoover was president. We had a Republican president when the Davis-Bacon Act was passed. Why was it passed?
Well, more than Hoover, you had an even much more Republican Congress than you have now. It was passed for a combination of good and bad reasons, like so many things were. It was passed at the behest of contractors who felt that they were being undercut by less scrupulous contractors. It was certainly supported by organized labor at the time. It was supported by Southern congressmen who felt, well, this will keep people of color out of the workforce effectively because they were being recruited to work essentially
lower wages.
And it was also an anti-immigrant measure at the time. But that's certainly not what it evolved. However, I may point out that one of the group of 35 who pressured Bush to suspend Davis-Bacon is Tom Tancredo, the vehemently anti-immigrant congressman from Colorado. So, I mean, it's interesting. The right-wing groups who hate Davis-Bacon keep calling it a Jim Crow measure, as if they supported civil rights in any other area. They don't. It's fascinating. But Davis-Bacon is very widespread at this point. It covers 20% of all construction projects in the United States and affects more than a quarter of all construction workers.
So Davis-Bacon doesn't just kick in when there's a disaster or something like
that? No. It has to do with federally financed construction projects, and it frequently extends beyond that. In addition, a number of states have similar laws, and the state laws, some of them preceded Davis-Bacon by quite a bit. Kansas had a prevailing wage law in 1891. New York had one before Davis-Bacon. These things are not unknown. What they're trying to do is, in part, is stabilize a very unstable industry, which is construction. And let me just point one thing here. Bush, of course, you know, he moved from paralysis and denial to quick action, pushing money to favored contractors, and then cutting this wage. You know what the prevailing wage is in New Orleans for contracting work?
I believe it's $9 an hour, isn't it?
$9 an hour. This was, the employers were, you know, they chafed under the yoke of oppression of $9 an hour.
So what Bush has done is he's done away with the law that would require Halliburton to pay local folks $9 an hour if they hire them to do cleanup, and now they can pay them anything above $5.25 an hour.
$5.15, I think. Yes, that's right. And let's see if they even pay that. But, it's kind of fascinating that his response to a crisis is to cut wages.
Now, the Republican sponsors of this bill were Jim Puddler, Jim Davis, and Robert Bacon. Davis was the senator from Pennsylvania. Bacon was the congressman from New York.
Right.
What was their motivation? Here you had a couple of Republicans. He was also the Secretary of Labor under three presidents, Puddler Jim Davis. Was it in their mind, was it all about racism? Was it all about...
No. I mean, I don't think that their racism was necessarily any deeper or more abiding than that of most congresspeople at the time. You know, obviously it inflects everything that happens, and it most certainly did at the time.
And at that time, we had an entirely white Congress as well.
Yes, it was entirely. This was well after the African Americans from Reconstruction had been booted out of Congress, and it reflected that. And in part, to get Southern votes on this, they had to accede to it. Not that Northern racism was lacking, but again, I don't think racism in and of itself was the motivation for this. I think the motivation was, in fact, as I said, it was pressure from the construction industry, and there was, even prior to the New Deal, there was an increase, as I understand it, in federally funded public works projects during the Hoover administration.
During the last 2 years of the Hoover administration,
that's
certainly,
right.
Because what they were doing is they were going into, I mean, you know, by 1930 they realized that they were in the middle of the Great Depression, had something that by the end of 1930 that this was out of control, and the bank failures were beginning in 31 and 30, I mean, you know, they really, really picked up steam 31, 32, 33. And so in some ways, Hoover was moving in a more progressive direction just because he saw Franklin Roosevelt coming up behind him and knew he was going to compete with him in 1932. I'm just trying to get an understanding of the forces that were at work in creating Davis-Bacon. Why would a construction industry ask for, if the Hoover administration and if Puddler Jim Davis and Robert Bacon, all Republicans, if they passed this thing, and they did it at the behest of industry, why would the construction industry want to make sure? Oh, I get it. It just hit me. The reason why is because if I'm a contractor in Louisiana, I'm the construction industry, and federal dollars are going to come down to me. I want to be able to get as many dollars as possible, and if I have to pay a prevailing wage, that means that it's federal dollars. Who cares how much I'm paying my employees?
Right.
In other words, this defines the amount of federal money coming in.
Yeah, it's a sort of a cost-plus deal on that. You know, this is the prevailing wage, or this is what we're paying. There was also there were some very noble sentiments in this, which is, and they're still upheld by the construction trade unions, which is, if you're forced to compete in price and go as low as you can, the work gets shoddier and shoddier.
Mm.
And this causes a lot of trouble, and particularly when you're responsible to the federal government, who can actually take action against you, as opposed to some poor homeowner who can't. You know, if you build a bridge with substandard labor and it falls down, you can pretty much guarantee there's going to be consequences for this. Whenever there's too much turmoil in an industry and perceived undercutting of whatever the standard is at the time, there will be...
It's bad for the industry.
Well, it's certainly bad for some segments of the industry, and the established firms did not like this. So... But it also benefited skilled workers, and as we point out in this case, those designated as skilled workers were usually white. And so there was a racial component to it. But then, as I said, that wasn't the primary reason or the primary motivation. As I also said, you know, there many states had tried this as well. There's a benefit in stability. And other industries, such as the garment industry, accepted unionization as a way to stabilize an unstable industry. It frequently, you know, just cost cutting and cutthroat stuff is not to the benefit of an industry.
Yeah.
And so this was the result.
We have about a minute left here, Alec. We're just speaking with Alec Dubrow, the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ilcaonline.org. Is there anything that Americans can do to get to force George W. Bush to unrescind the Davis-Bacon Act in these flood-stricken areas?
Well, I mean, you know, the White House is at a certain public relations disadvantage at the moment. I'm not sure that scattered phone calls are going to make him change his mind. It certainly wouldn't hurt. I mean, work through your elected representative.
Pressure your member of Congress, in other words. Call 1-877-SOB-USOB and ask for your senator or for your member of Congress.
Unless you happen to live in the jurisdiction that I do, in which case you don't have a member of Congress. But otherwise, go to it. And certainly, complaints directed toward FEMA, which is letting some of these contracts themselves. By the way, just one last one on this.
Okay.
You realize that one of the contractors that they hired is Blackwater.
Yeah.
You heard that? Yeah, this is fantastic.
Yeah, and Blackwater is paying $350 a day to their people, by the way. They're not worried about the Davis-Bacon Act.
No, none
at all. Alec Dubrow with the International Labor Communications Association, ilcaonline.org. Thank you very much for being with us, Alec. We'll talk to you again next week. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends.
Come all you good workers, good news to you, I'll tell of how the good old union has come in here to dwell.
Which side you gonna be on?
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
George W. Bush has made it very clear he's not on the side of working Americans, unless they happen to be mercenaries for Blackwater. Otherwise, forget it! Forget it! 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Dave in Allenstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program. What's up?
B-12 or niacin. Tom?
Yes, sir, you're live.
How are you? Yeah, 2 points, and I would appreciate your perspective, but I do have one quick heads up for your listeners in the Manhattan area or those in the surrounding area that commute there regularly like myself. There is a great debate that's going to happen tonight at Baruch College with George Galloway and Chris Hitchens, who is a conservative columnist from England.
That should be a good
one. Yeah, it's also going to be on C-SPAN and another station sometime over the next couple of days for those
who
will be seeing.
I'll have to look for that. We had George Galloway on this program a couple of days ago. Brilliant guy. Brilliant guy. Anyhow.
Okay. I don't understand. Well, I do understand. These guys are so predictable in terms of their reaction. They're either going to exploit or or and take credit, or they're going to you know, find a scapegoat almost on every issue. I don't understand why, since they're so predictable, we are not more proactive in terms of heading this off at the pass before it happens. I mean, I don't know why we're not right now flying banners with small planes with banners across the Midwest, warning people. And I say the Midwest because that is the crucial area that we have to concentrate on if we're going to win back the House and Senate. I mean, I think the East is strong, and so is far west. I don't understand why we're not, you know, doing things such as flying small planes with banners saying in advance, expect Bush to be bringing back the troops next spring. He's going to exploit their lives up until then. I mean,
I guarantee you, it's going to happen. I mean, it's very simple. These guys have everything that they do is about politics and power. George W. Bush told his biographer way back when, back in 1999, the guy who is writing, who is ghostwriting his biography, his autobiography, A Charge to Keep, that, you know, if he became president, if he had a chance to invade Iraq, he was going to get the political capital from it. He wasn't going to blow it like his father did and just have a 100-hour war. No, it was going to be a big deal. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Good morning. You're calling in on one of our regular rotation lines, and so you're just in the stack of all the folks on hold. And normally you call in on the hotline here, and I can see you. So I'm sorry I missed you. I didn't see you on that line.
No, I apologize. I dialed the normal number.
Okay.
I'm doing something wrong.
After we're finished, pop on hold, and I'll make sure that you've got the right number because we don't need to do this inside baseball stuff on the air. What's up? What's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, Democrats are getting increasingly frustrated with Judge Roberts because he's just not answering any questions. At least that's what they say.
Right.
And some Republicans are also getting a bit frustrated because he's not answering their questions on the issue of abortion. So we've got senators from both sides.
So you've got Republicans worried that they've got a David Souter here?
I think so.
Or are Republicans, you know, let's take it one level, one more Niccolo Machiavelli or Karl Rove level deeper. Do you have Republicans pretending to be worried that they have a David Souter so that they can reassure Democrats that they shouldn't vote against this guy or filibuster him, because then the Democrats will think that maybe it's a David Souter, when in fact the Republicans know that the first thing he's going to do when he becomes Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is schedule a Roe v. Wade case and blow the thing out of the water?
I actually don't think that it might be the latter with a very few senators, but I think the majority of senators actually do have their own genuine concerns. But, of course, you know, Karl Rove issues mean almost anything can happen these days, almost anything. But there are rumblings that the Democrats are getting ticked off enough that several of them, maybe even all of them, might not vote him out of committee. That wouldn't stop, of course, because there's certainly enough votes to get him onto the floor. But that's a rumbling also.
Right, but he's going to get on the floor, and it's going to be a majority vote, and the Democrats are not going to risk filibustering this guy because he doesn't have horns, and he looks nice on TV, and they play pictures
right.
of his little kids.
That's right.
And most Americans aren't paying attention to what's being said and what's done, just, you know, a few political junkies here. And what do you think the possibility is, Victoria Jones, what do you think the possibility is that he actually may become his own man when he's on the Supreme Court? His history doesn't seem to indicate that there's even a chance of that. He's been absolutely consistent all during the last 25 years that he's been in public life and in private life as a hardcore conservative. But, you know, what do you think the chances are?
I've thought about that because I want to believe that he can become his own man, because some of the questions that he's been asked, he's answered in kind of an interesting way. But he's a clever man, so that could mean anything. I tend to think that even if he does become his own man, that man is going to be more Scalia-like than anything else.
Yeah, yeah. And Justice Scalia, the one who tells us that you want rights, pass a law. You know, it's like I had a call yesterday from somebody. I don't see the right to abortion in the Constitution. I'm sorry, neither is the right to chew your food. The Constitution doesn't give us rights. It limits the powers of government. We have all the rights. But that's a whole other rant. Victoria, thanks for the report. It'll be interesting to track this down. Hang on just a second. I'll be right with you.
Yes, I will.
Okay. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. 27 and a half minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, I'm just a typical American boy from a typical American town. I believe in God and Senator Dodd and I keep an old Castro down.
There you go.
And when it came my time to serve, I knew better death than red. But when I got to my old draft board, buddy, this is what I said. Sarge, I'm only 18. I got a ruptured spleen and I always carry a purse. I've got eyes like a bat and my feet are flat. My asthma's getting worse.
Excuse me, that's what Dick Cheney said. It's what Rush Limbaugh said. It's what all. It's what Bill Kristol said. It's what all those. It's what Wolfowitz said. It's not what I said. Not what you said, Phil Oakes. Or was that Phil Oakes? I'm not sure. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. 25 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894. A telephone number. We'll get to your calls in just a second. First, I want to just raise this question. George Bush has taken responsibility. I'm curious if and when he's going to answer the question, since he's now the responsible party, why some of these things happened. Here is Aaron Broussard on Meet the Press, NBC's Meet the Press with Tim Russert, national television. Aaron Broussard, the president of Jefferson Parish, the equivalent of the county commissioner of Jefferson County, only in Louisiana they use, you know, president and parish kind of work. Anyhow, the president of Jefferson Parish, Louisiana, on Meet the Press.
We had Walmart deliver three trucks of water, trailer trucks of water. FEMA turned them back. They said we didn't need them. This was a week ago. FEMA, we had 1,000 gallons of diesel fuel on a Coast Guard vessel docked in my parish. The Coast Guard said, come get the fuel right away. When we got there with our trucks, they got a word. FEMA says, don't give you the fuel. Yesterday, FEMA comes in and cuts all of our emergency communication lines. They cut them without notice. Our sheriff, Harry Lee, goes back in. He reconnects the line. He posts armed guards on our line and says, no one's getting near these lines.
Now, why would that happen? That was the president of Jefferson Parish, and the stories continue. Here's another one. A group of volunteer firefighters from Houston were not allowed to enter New Orleans after they waited outside New Orleans since Tuesday for FEMA to let them help in New Orleans or else use them somewhere else in the stricken region. FEMA's region? They won't let anyone in until the National Guard has secured the city, they said. FEMA won't let the Red Cross deliver food. You can find this on the Red Cross's website, saying that they wouldn't allow them in. The Homeland Security Department has requested and continues to request that the American Red Cross not come back into New Orleans, said Renita Hosler, spokeswoman for the Red Cross. FEMA blocks a 500-boat citizen flotilla from delivering aid. FEMA told 500 police-escorted boats trying to rescue Katrina victims in Jefferson Parish that they had to turn around and would not be allowed to help in the rescue mission. FEMA, first responders urged not to respond. This from a news release from FEMA. www.fema.gov/news/newsrelease.fema?id=18470. It's right there on the FEMA website. Head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency urged all fire and emergency service departments not to respond to counties and states affected by Hurricane Katrina without being requested and lawfully dispatched by state and local authorities. Why? Why? Why?
We had Walmart deliver three trucks of water, trailer trucks of water. FEMA turned them back. They said we didn't need them. This was a week ago. FEMA, we had 1,000 gallons of diesel fuel on a Coast Guard vessel docked in my parish. The Coast Guard said, come get the fuel right away. When we got there with our trucks, they got a word. FEMA says, don't give you the fuel. Yesterday, FEMA comes in and cuts all of our emergency communication lines. They cut them without notice. Our sheriff, Harry Lee, goes back in. He reconnects the line. He posts armed guards on our line and says, no one's getting near these lines.
Now, in the midst of all this, we discover that this from Knight Ritter today. Today, today's paper, it'll probably be published in tomorrow's newspaper. It's online on Knight Ritter's website today. You can also find it at commondreams.org. It's one of the headlines. The headline, Chertoff delayed federal response memo shows. It wasn't Michael Brown. It was Michael Chertoff. Let me just, the first three paragraphs of the story, just straight read. I am not changing a word in this. This is just as it reads. The federal official with the power to mobilize a massive federal response to Hurricane Katrina was Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, not the former FEMA chief who was relieved of his duties and resigned earlier this week. Federal documents reviewed by Knight Ridder show. Even before the storm struck the Gulf Coast, Chertoff could have ordered federal agencies into action without any request from state or local officials. Federal Emergency Management Agency Chief Michael Brown had only limited authority to do so until about 36 hours after the storm hit, when Chertoff designated him as the principal federal official in charge of the storm. As thousands of hurricane victims went without food, water, and shelter in the days after Katrina's early morning August 29 landfall, critics assailed Brown for being responsible for delays that might have cost hundreds of lives. But Chertoff, not Brown, was in charge of managing the national response to a catastrophic disaster, according to the National Response Plan, the federal government's blueprint for how agencies will handle major natural disasters or terrorist incidents. An order issued by President Bush in 2003 also assigned that responsibility to the Homeland Security Director. But according to a memo obtained by Knight Ridder, Chertoff did not shift that power to Brown until late afternoon or evening on August 30th, 36 hours after Katrina hit Louisiana and Mississippi. Why? Why? Why did this happen? And then you've got Aaron Broussard telling the story to Tim Russert.
Street Canal that the secretary didn't foresee, a 300-foot breach. I just completed it yesterday with convoys of National Guard and local parish workers and levee board people.
The
it
secretary
took us two
being
and a half days working 24/7. I just closed it. I'm telling you, most importantly, I want to thank my public employees that have worked 24/7. They're burnt out, the doctors, the nurses. And I want to give you one last story, and I'll shut up and let you tell me whatever you want to tell me. The guy who runs this building I'm in, emergency management, he's responsible for everything. His mother was trapped in St. Bernard Nursing Home. And every day she called him and said, are you coming, son? Is somebody coming? And she said, yeah, mama, somebody's coming to get you. Somebody's coming to get you on Tuesday. Somebody's coming to get you on Wednesday. Somebody's coming to get you on Thursday. Somebody's coming to get you on Friday. And she drowned Friday night. She drowned Friday night.
Mr. President.
Nobody's coming to get us. Nobody's coming to get us. The secretary has promised. Everybody's promised. They've had press conferences. I'm sick of the press conferences. For God's sakes, shut up and send us somebody.
Just take a pause, Mr.
And that's Aaron Broussard, the president of Jefferson Parish, on Meet the Press. And I'm sure you've heard that before, but it's lest we forget. You know, it's so easy to forget. And then you look at the Katrina timeline, and then you look at these Republican emails that are going around, these absolutely mind-boggling, incredible emails that are going around that are saying over and over and over again, oh, President Bush was begging Catherine Blanco to take Blanco to accept aid. Sorry. Read the new issue of Newsweek. It'll be on the stands this week. Bush's advisors had to draw straws to decide who got the terrible job of informing him that there were people drowning. This was on Thursday. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Rich in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Rich, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I just wanted to say I was listening to Stephanie Miller this morning and then you today, and I called in because I'm surprised I haven't heard anyone else say this, that I know the name Hitler gets thrown around a lot, but if you look at the end of World War II, Hitler was doing things that are a lot like what George Bush is telling people to do now. He gave explicit orders he wasn't to be given any bad news. He was sleeping late. He gave orders that nothing was to be done without his direct command.
Right.
And now we're hearing that, you know, Bush, ever after talking to the governor of Louisiana, went to sleep that
right.
night.
Yeah.
They said on Stephanie Miller's show. Also, like if you look at on D-Day, you know, Hitler said, "Well, hold the tanks back. Don't put them near the beach. I don't want anything done until I wake up." He had told all of his people he wasn't to be disturbed when he was asleep, and he wasn't to be given bad news. So the landings happened at 6 a.m., and then it was 11 o'clock before he woke up and someone dared to say, "Hey, the Allies are here."
Yeah,
and he released the armor, and it was too late. And many lives, fortunately on their side in that case, had been lost. But,
yeah.
I mean,
no, actually,
this is a pattern.
I understand. And, in fact, a good friend of mine who may well be listening to the program right now, I know he frequently does, listens to us on KBBR in Coos Bay, Oregon, where he lives, Armin Lehman, was the teenage courier who was the last courier to deliver a message to Adolf Hitler in the Führer bunker.
No kidding.
He was a member of the Hitler Youth. He was like 14, 15 years old at
wow.
the time. And, you know, Armin tells these stories about how Hitler was just losing it. He was just, you know, he was his hands were trembling. Nobody could approach him with bad news. He was denying reality. And Bush does not read newspapers, does not watch TV. And you had this situation. In fact, Armin wrote a great book about it. It's called, I think it's called In the Führer Bunker. The original title was Hitler's Last Courier.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah, and you can find the book out there. And Armin Lehman is a brilliant guy. We got to get him on the program one of these days. Again, Armin's been on before. And, yeah, it's like, you know, what kind of psychosis is going on here that his aides had to draw straws to give him bad news? 15 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's a beautiful day.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, it's a beautiful day. Every day you wake up and breathing, it's a beautiful day. Welcome back to our program. And now to top it off, we discover that, as far as I can tell, now I've seen two news reports about this. I haven't, you know, I really want to dig a little deeper before I say this is the absolute reality, but it looks like Service Corporation International, a Texas-based company owned by friends of the Bush family, which has been implicated in illegally discarding and desecrating corpses in the past, has been hired by FEMA to deal with the body count from Hurricane Katrina. The body count has been outsourced to a crony corporation of the Bush family. Raw Story reports, the Menorah Garden Cemetery chain owned by SCI desecrated vaults, removed hundreds of bodies from two cemeteries in Florida, dumped the gruesome remains in woods frequented by wild hogs, investigators discovered in 2001. You know, on and on it goes. More as this story develops. We'll see how this thing plays out. Duncan in Louisiana. Hey, Duncan, what's up?
Tom, I think I got the answer to why. In my opinion, your timeline shows that Blanco followed the National Response Plan procedures,
yes,
which was signed off by everybody in cabinet level and Bush, Chertoff, and Cheney.
That's correct.
All right, and Bush responded appropriately, but
by declaring a national emergency, and then he essentially handed
right.
it off to Chertoff, who did nothing.
But he tried to get Blanco to sign off on getting the Louisiana, turning over control of the Louisiana National Guard to the federal authorities. And when Blanco refused, that's when the foot dragging started, I think.
You know, I've heard that story a couple of times, Duncan, but to the best of my knowledge, Blanco doesn't, there's no there. Once Blanco turns over to FEMA, once she says to the president, please declare a national emergency, she has already federalized the National Guard.
I understand that, but you don't
it's a done deal.
Man, no. You don't tell this man no. It doesn't matter whether it's a done deal or not. When you tell him no, you're going to pay for
no,
it.
No, no. What I'm saying is my understanding is that she never told him no. That whole thing is just made up. There would have been no reason for her to tell him no because there was no no to tell him.
Well, now, I'll have to check into that a little more.
I'm telling you, she couldn't tell him no when he took her National Guard and sent them to Iraq. Here in the state of Oregon, our governor has gone to every single National Guardsman's funeral. He's been to 54 funerals now. He's going crazy from going to funerals. I had him on my radio program. He said he doesn't have the power to control the National Guard. The president says he's mobilizing the National Guard. They're gone.
Oh, okay.
So I think this is one of those right-wing talking points that's going around there, Duncan.
Well, it may be. And what's more important, though, and you mentioned it earlier, was that Davis Bacon Act.
Yeah.
And
it reveals the real agenda. The real agenda is use anything, even a disaster, to screw the average working person.
Which is why I think they need to quit embarrassing America and take those United States lapel pins off and put the Jolly Roger lapel pin on.
Well, actually, the flag that these guys, that these Republicans should be wearing is the flag of Communist China, because that's the country to whom they're giving our sovereignty. That's the country to whom they're giving all of our jobs and industries. That's the country that owns so much of our debt that now, in 24 hours, that country could bring us to our knees. And that's the country that in the last few months has threatened to nuke 100 of our cities and has the ability to do it. And we've done nothing about it. We're yelling and screaming about Iran, which doesn't even have nukes yet. So,
then we ought to send them some lapel pins for the Chinese flag and the Jolly Roger to show everybody what pirates they really are.
There you go. Well said, Duncan. Thank you much for the call. Great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Tom in Minneapolis. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. You know what scares me about Roberts are those crazed, bulging eyes. Geez, you see that in the hearing?
Yeah, I think he might be a little hyperthyroid, but...
My wife goes, what's with the eyes? But,
yeah.
You know, at the beginning of the show, you mentioned Bush and psychoanalysis and all this his weird behavior. And
yeah.
I think the Democrats have to change strategy and expose a lot of these GOP members as emotionally unstable and irrational. Did you see last night or yesterday during the hearing and the Daily Show guy, John Stewart, showed this, what's his name, Senator from Oklahoma, Tom Coburn.
Yeah, crying.
Yeah, crocodile.
Yeah. And yet Coburn in 2004 versus his opponent, he says it's a battle of good versus evil.
That's right.
And on the Oklahoma legislature, he says you have a bunch of crap heads in Oklahoma City that have killed the vision of anybody wanting to invest in Oklahoma. I'm quoting this Republican senator on doctors. He says, I favor the death penalty for abortionists and other people who take life. He says the gay community has infiltrated the very centers of power in every area across this country. They wield extreme power. Right. This is the guy who's breaking down and crying. Scott in Seattle. Hey, Scott, we've got about a minute and a half left. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to comment that one thing that particularly concerns me about the news coverage of Hurricane Katrina is that I have heard absolutely nothing about how this hurricane has affected the gay quarters or the gay populations that have been affected in the hurricane.
Well, I would suspect that they're as wrapped up in the disaster and swept away by it as are all the rest of all the various communities of Louisiana.
Yeah.
Are you wired into the gay community to the extent that, like reading The Advocate and things? I mean, are the gay publications, are the gay websites talking about, here's how you can connect with folks who have evacuated out of New Orleans and are looking for places to go?
Well, in fact, I've contributed to both the Rainbow World Fund and the Hope for Peace and Justice.
Great.
I've contributed to those charities, but I've heard absolutely nothing about how those populations are being affected.
Well, why don't you check it out, and if you find out anything, let us know. I'm curious, and I'll see if I can get somebody from the Human Rights Campaign on here in Portland. They're regulars on our morning program anyway, and see what they know about the situation.
I'd appreciate that.
In fact, a family member of mine used to work with them. So thanks a lot, Scott. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. What are we going to do, my friends? What are we going to do? We are going to take this country back. We have no choice. Don't you see democracy sliding away right in front of our eyes? You got a guy running for the Supreme Court who's been nominated for the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice, who just 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, rules that the president can ignore the Constitution and keep people in prison forever just because he decides to? It really and truly is time to take back the House and the Senate. That means getting politically active now.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, podcasting on Apple's iTunes, and on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. 45.8 million Americans are likely to suffer and die because they lack health insurance. This is no small issue. It's one that we perennially revisit in the United States. Harry Truman was actually the first president to propose a national health care system back in 1947, as I recall. He was defeated by the Republicans who had taken control of the House of Representatives and the Senate in 1946. And the issue has been out there ever since. What he did successfully was he said, okay, we can't do it here. With the Marshall Act and helping rebuild Germany and Japan, we'll show the world, you know, what some good liberals can do. And they created national health insurance programs in both Germany and Japan, and strong worker protections, laws that protected unionization, a whole host of liberal reforms. And, gee, it seems to work very well. Whereas in Iraq, we have this neocon dystopia, the exact opposite. And you can see the contrast. But in any case, it's time to, I think we need to revisit this on a regular basis. Karen Davenport is with us. Karen is the Director of Health Policy at the Center for American Progress. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
Glad to have you with us. What is the state, Dr. Karen, how's the wellness of America? What's the state of our health care system?
Well, I think both in the state of our healthcare system and our wellness as a people, we're not where we want to be. The most recent estimates, as you alluded to, 45.8 million Americans don't have health insurance, and that's 800,000 more than the estimate from the year before. You know, at the same time, obviously not having healthcare, or health coverage, rather, certainly has an effect on a lot of the, you know, health statistics that we care about, whether that's life expectancy or infant mortality or, you know, a range of other concerns that people have. You know, what's so stark to me is that this is a problem that just continues to grow. This is the 10th time since, you know, 1993, when we were really seriously talking about this issue, that the number of Americans without health insurance has grown, and yet we're no closer to embracing change as a nation.
But the right-wingers are out there running around saying, hey, you know, it doesn't matter. Somebody doesn't have health insurance. They can, you know, no hospital can turn people away. But the reality is they don't realize that while they're mouthing these right-wing talking points, the conservative, I mean, they're conservative Democrats doing this as well. It's not just Republicans. These so-called conservative talking points, that they're actually paying for those people when they show up in the hospital emergency rooms. If you have, for example, a kid with asthma, if they have health insurance and they can see a doctor and have it covered, it costs $15 for them to get a prescription and an inhaler to deal with their asthma. They show up in an ER and it's going to cost $500-$600.
That's right.
And we all pay for that.
We do, and I think, and even more broadly, the fact that you know, healthcare costs are growing, and yet more and more people don't have health insurance. This is a drag on our economy generally, and so in many ways, we're all paying for this.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons why I believe it was Toyota. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was Toyota. Recently, was shopping around to build a new car factory in North America, and I know that Alabama, I believe it was Alabama, at least one of the southern states, actually thought they had it in the bag. Might have been Louisiana, and had offered them all kinds. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks and incentives and free land and all kinds of, you know, all kinds of stuff. And Toyota, as I recall, decided to go to Canada instead because they don't have to pay $2,000-$3,000 per worker in insurance costs because everybody in Canada is insured, period. The employers
right.
don't have to pay for it. So even with all those tax incentives, our healthcare system, our privatized healthcare system in the United States, which is costing us about twice as much as any other country in the world, overall, is not providing the health care that we need and is causing us to be uncompetitive. Now, I've noticed that the Center for American Progress, your group, AmericanProgress.org, which in my mind is one of the finest progressive organizations out there, and you know, a great think tank, and so pleased that you guys exist, and you know, very just it's great what you're doing, and you have come out with a proposal to fix the national health care program, but it involves using existing health insurance companies and HMOs and private organizations. Why not simply go back to the rules in that regard that were extant in the United States in the 50s and 60s and early 70s that said that if you're going to run a hospital, its first goal has to be to keep people well, not to make a profit? In other words, it has to be nonprofit. It can't be for-profit. If you're going to run a health insurance company, it has to be nonprofit. Its first goal has to be to keep people well rather than to turn a profit for its shareholders. Or, better than that, why not simply say Medicare is now available to everyone, period. Your Social Security number is your ID number, like they do in Germany, and turn Medicare into a single-payer health care system and get rid of the health care companies altogether. Is it that it's just not politically feasible? Or am I missing something here? Is there a better way of doing it?
Well, I think there are a lot of different ways of doing it, and frankly, I would really, and I think the Center for American Progress would really welcome that we would have a debate that's very serious and engaged on the different ways to do it, and I think all of the ideas that you laid out are things that need to be discussed. The plan that Center for American Progress put together, we decided that we would take an approach that builds on and strengthens the current system simply because we felt like we needed to put out for public debate something that could happen, that we could hopefully engage, you know, not just progressives and people who are firmly committed to expanding health insurance for everybody, but that could draw in others who care about health care, others who care about our economy, but might not be comfortable with some of the other choices. Now, I think, you know, one of the greatest things we could have is a national debate on what is really the right way to go and a commitment to do something.
Right, because that would presuppose that there was a reason to do something different.
Right. That's right. You know, and I know there are folks who are very committed to doing a Medicare for All approach. The approach that we've put out is based on the Medicaid program and then having new options for private coverage and trying to improve the value of coverage that everybody has. But I think the goals are all very much the same, which is that, you know, every family, every person would have health insurance, and, you know, no matter what happens to them, that they have health care coverage.
Isn't it a fundamental reality, though, Karen Davenport, of the health policy director of the Center for American Progress, isn't it a fundamental reality that as long as money rules in Washington, D.C., as long as Buckley versus Viejo and the, you know, these other decisions of the Supreme Court that have given corporations rights to speak, as long as that prevails, that we're not going to have that discussion that we need to have?
You know, I don't think so, and I hope I'm not hopelessly naive about this, but I think that this is actually an issue where there are a lot of businesses, whether they are large or small, that they are really feeling the pressure of healthcare costs. There was a study that just came out yesterday from one of the big consulting firms suggesting that healthcare premiums will go up another 10% next year. I think that certainly one of the hurdles to achieving universal coverage is just how big healthcare is in our economy. It's, you know, between 14 and 15% of gross domestic product. But that also means that it's an enormous budget item for our federal budget, for the states, for large employers and small employers and families, and it's something that I think if we look at our collective self-interest that we need to really do something about.
So how do we initiate that conversation, Karen?
Well, I think that part of it is to have our policymakers and our political leaders need to get engaged in this.
So we need to rattle our cages.
I think that's right.
We need to. You need to call toll free the toll free secret number for the White House operator, for the Capitol Hill operator, the old Senate Office Building toll free number, which is not published but actually works just fine. You can call your and ask for your Congress member of Congress or your senator 1-877-SOB-USOB. It's the old Senate Office Building, United States Senate Office Building. Call 1-877-SOB-USOB. Ask for your member of Congress and say, please, we've got to do something about the health care situation. Karen Davenport, great guest. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
The Director of Health Policy at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website, if you want more information. And some great programs there. You can get a lot of information, not just on health care, but on all things political. It is 17 minutes. A lot of information, not just on health care, but on all things political. It is 17 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Senate yesterday. This is so sad. The Senate, by a 51-47 vote, largely along party lines, voted to basically, you know, without going through that, it was a vote to defeat a resolution that would have called on the EPA to rewrite rule. It sounds very complicated because it's basically a triple negative. It was a vote to allow something, to change something that was stopping something that was starting something, right? So it sounds very confusing, but here's the bottom line. Bill Clinton said to the power industry in the United States, you got to clean up your mercury emissions. This mercury is poisoning people. We've got so much mercury in our environment now. It's concentrating in the food chain, particularly in the fish, and it's poisoning people. We have an epidemic of autism that seems to be connected to it. You've got pregnant women who have high levels of mercury in their systems, children born with high levels of mercury. We know it's a neurotoxin. We know it's destructive to the way the mind and the nervous system works. Do something. You got to fix it, and here's the standards. George W. Bush comes into office and he says, we don't need those standards. We're going to change them. We're going to make it, you know, instead of you got to change it this year, we'll make it 2018, you got to start changing them. And instead of you got to change it, you know, drop it by 90%, we'll make it, you got to drop it by 70%. Of course, you know, that's what industry wanted, right? And it's not like there's not the technology to do it. All they got to do is slap some scrubbers on their smokestacks. But it would cost millions of dollars. Millions of dollars to an industry, you know, to companies like ExxonMobil that just showed a $10 billion profit for a quarter. A profit! The largest profit in the history of not just the oil industry, of any industry. The most profitable company, the most profitable quarter in the history, in the 230-some-odd-year history of the United States of America. Can't afford to put scrubbers on smokestacks, sorry. So some members of the Senate tried to go in and say, okay, let's change the rules back to the way it was during the Clinton era so that this industry has to clean up this mercury. And the Senate voted 51-47 not to allow that to happen. New York Times reports, even if the Senate had passed the resolution, it had little chance to go further. Such challenges require approval of the House, which was unlikely to act, as well as the president's signature, and President Bush's senior advisors would recommend that he veto the effort. Oklahoma Republican James N. M. Inhofe. These people, it's like they want to. It's you know, I almost said it. It's like they're. I almost said they're like baby killers. But really, you know, that's the hysterical rhetoric of the anti-abortion right and left, I suppose, for that matter. But it's what's happening. I mean, you get a lot of mercury, you have miscarriages, you have children born with mental retardation, you have all sorts of birth defects. James Inhofe, who's all in favor of this apparently, the Republican chairman of the Environment and Public Works Committee, says, I'm extremely encouraged by the Senate's resolve to support a market-based approach to reducing mercury pollution and not to impede clean air progress by rolling back the existing regulation. Do you get the slimy lies in that? Six Democrats, by the way, joined the 45 Republicans to create a majority. I want to know who those Democrats are. Perhaps David can find out here. We'll assign that to David Poole. I want to nail these guys. I just want to nail them. I mean, this is our children we're talking about here. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Alice in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Alice.
Good morning, Tom. Would you consider the possibility that it was all very deliberate when Bush finally got there? He told FEMA what a good job they were doing while the Democrats were dying.
No. I don't. I think that my guess on it, my most recent guess on it, based on this Reuters story that I saw about Michael Chertoff, is that Chertoff didn't realize that he was the guy in charge, that they had reorganized this thing. They had taken the power away from FEMA, given it to Homeland Security, and Chertoff thought Brown was in charge, and Brown thought Chertoff was in charge. Actually, Chertoff was in charge, and he didn't do anything. And that Bush wasn't offering any leadership at all because he wasn't paying attention because he doesn't read newspapers and doesn't watch TV. That's what I think happened, Alice. But,
yeah.
You know, I acknowledge that some people think that there was a deliberate conspiracy to kill Democrats, and I can't disprove that. So I'm not dismissing it out of hand. I just think it's real unlikely. But I appreciate your calling and raising the possibility.
Okay.
Thank you. Keep up the good work. Good to hear from you. Marianne in Humboldt County, California. Hey, with a lot of listeners from KGOE. What's up, Marianne?
Yes, good morning. I wanted to tell you, maybe you know already, that SOB, USOB number has been disconnected.
You're kidding.
I called 1-877, SOB, USOB on Friday, and it had been disconnected.
I called it this morning.
I called it again this morning.
Well, you're dialing SOB, the letter U, and for O, it's the letter O, not the number zero.
Yeah, no,
right.
S-O, S and up to O, O, and so anyway.
It's something like 6, 7, 8, I don't have a keyboard in front of me, but I dialed it this morning. I called Senator Smith's office this morning to find out how he voted on the mercury thing, the Republican from Oregon.
Okay.
He actually voted against it, God bless him.
Right.
But it's still working. It's still working.
They took it out from here then, from this area?
No, I think you must have misdialed. Try it again, Marianne, 1-877. If you dial 866, you get the Marine Recruiting Office. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 27 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So a new
And welcome back. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, right after Hurricane Katrina, the White House staffers, apropos to Alice's call, the White House staffers were absolutely terrified. By the way, during the break, we called 877-SOB-USOB. It still works. It's the actual numbers, 1-877-762-8762. That's the toll-free number for the Capitol Hill switchboard. And you can then ask for your senator. You can say, hey, I'd like to speak to Senator Smith or Senator Kennedy or whoever. And you can also say, I'd like to speak to my member of Congress, but I'm not even sure who it is. Here's my zip code. They'll look it up for you and they'll connect you. Or you can say, I'd like to speak with the White House. And you can leave a message for Dick Cheney or George Bush or Condi Rice or Michael Chertoff or anybody you wish. And it's toll-free. It's 1-877-SOB-USOB. And or 1-877-762-8762. And it should work from all across the United States. Not sure if it works in Canada or not, but it's the old Senate office building toll-free number for senators to use. And it's not published anywhere. You can only learn about it here on this program. So anyhow, Newsweek reports. This is the new issue of Newsweek just hitting the stands. And lest you think I'm exaggerating, I'll quote from Newsweek. Some White House staffers were watching the evening news. Now, this is Wednesday. Storm hit Sunday night, right? This is Wednesday. Some White House staffers were watching the evening news and thought the president needed to see the horrific reports coming out of New Orleans. You see, they end of quote from Newsweek. See, they knew that Bush doesn't watch TV because he's afraid he'll see something that might hurt his feelings. And he doesn't read newspapers because he really has no interest in knowing what's going on. And he's bragged about this. I mean, in press conferences, he's talked about it. He's said rather than hearing the news from the newspapers, he'd rather hear it directly from his own people. But his own people are terrified to tell him anything that he doesn't want to hear. So back to Newsweek. Newsweek reports Counselor Dan Bartlett made up a DVD of the newscasts so Bush could see them in their entirety as he flew down to the Gulf Coast the next morning on Air Force One. End quote. They talk about how, while Bush seems like an affable, nice guy in public, in private he can be a little scary. Cold, actually, is the word that Newsweek uses. And so here you have George W. Bush, you know, eating cake with John McCain and playing the guitar out in San Diego while people are drowning in New Orleans, and he doesn't know it. Because he won't turn on a TV, he won't read a newspaper, and none of his aides are willing to tell him because they're so terrified that he may blow up at them. Well, if it takes making a DVD and showing it to George Bush so he can figure out that there's a natural disaster going on, apparently nobody has bothered to make a DVD to tell him about what's going on in Iraq. That we're still, you know, an average of one a day of our American soldiers are dying in Iraq. So that George Bush could have his political capital, the reason that he gave his biographer in 1999 for why he wanted to have a war with Iraq. And the only reason that continues to make any sense at all, that he did it for political purposes. There's still no constitution. It's been 5 weeks from the vote. 5 weeks out. They still haven't concluded negotiations on a draft constitution. This from Reuters. Day before yesterday. It remains unclear when the final text may be printed. See, the 5 million copies of the constitution were supposed to have been distributed to the Iraqi public so they could read it before the vote. They have a referendum on October 15th. Reconstruction. Well, we're still writing checks to Halliburton, but not much is happening. Representative Jim Colby, Republican from Arizona, calls the reconstruction effort, quote, slower, more painful, more complex, more fragmented, and more efficient than anyone in Washington or Baghdad could have imagined a couple of years ago, end quote. That human rights are in the tank. We're back to the Saddam era. That according to the United Nations Human Rights Report from last week, it described consistent reports of systematic torture in police stations. And they're constantly finding dead people on the streets, corpses often bearing signs of torture, apparently, quote, victims of extrajudicial executions, end quote. Now, this all began, of course, right after Death Squad John took over being the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. John Negroponte, he went down to Central America, and all of a sudden we had death squads in Central America. This during the Reagan administration. And then he goes over to Iraq, and within a few weeks, all of a sudden, bodies start appearing in the streets in Iraq. Alice, you want a conspiracy theory? Here's mine. I think Negroponte went over there and organized a militia, an underground militia, that he said, okay, let's bring the death squads back. And they've been operating ever since. I could be wrong, but it just sure looks like it to me. And we know that that's what happened in Central America. So we have a human rights factor. Maybe somebody should make a DVD for George about this. The National Guard stretched so thin by simultaneous assignments as the Center for American Progress in Iraq and the hurricane-ravaged Gulf Coast that leaders in state houses and Congress say it's time to reconsider how the force is used, according to the Associated Press. Lieutenant General Stephen Blum, head of the National Guard Bureau, shortages caused by the war in Iraq actually delayed the National Guard response in Mississippi and Louisiana by at least a full day. And the Guard in Iraq, who are from the Gulf Coast, refused even 15-day leaves. They were told by their commanders, sorry, too few forces in Iraq to spare them. Mind-boggling. 1-877, that's for Congress, that's 1-877-SOB-USOB. To call us, 1-866-889-8894. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. What's up, Gary?
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
September 17th is Saturday. I believe our Constitution was signed on September 17th. And
I'm sorry, would you say that again, Gary? I missed.
September 17th, I believe, our Constitution was the day we signed our Constitution.
Our Constitution, the United States.
In September 17th.
1789.
And I don't want to use that, but I want to parlay this into, and it's just a side note, I'm lucky to I'll be 60 Saturday on Constitution Day. And however, I must say this. George Bush, number two, is the worst president. I don't take solace in saying this. Is the worst president of my lifetime.
I think
even worse than. Let me finish, please.
Sure.
Even worse than Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon, even in 1971 exactly, was open to national health care insurance. He was open to that idea in 1971. This is one specific true reason why George Bush, number two, in all due respect to the President of the United States, is the worst president of my lifetime.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I would say he is probably the second worst president in the history of the United States, behind now, John Adams.
Now, in addition to that, I did call you specifically. I did get a letter back from Senator Santorum's office in Washington. As you recall, back in August, you had a person on that was at a book signing. Now, you refresh my memory about that.
Well, there was a book signing Santorum was at. There was a private security guard there. Somebody came in and made a comment to somebody else in line that they had, I don't remember the details now, that they had some book that was anti-Santorum,
right,
and they were going to ask him to sign it. And people who weren't even affiliated with them but just happened to be standing by them got arrested and thrown out of the bookstore.
And so wrong. It just absolutely, as a listener, I'm no different than anybody else. I'm just appalled by it, and I still am. I got a letter back today, and that's one of the reasons why I called.
And what did the letter say?
And basically, the second paragraph said this. Well, I would like to respond specifically to your comments. Senate ethics rules prohibit senators from using official resources for personal purposes. This prohibition extends to responses to constituent mail. Excuse me, I messed the word up. That is directed towards or relating to my book. Accordingly, I am unable to respond to your specific concern.
Oh, give me a break.
That's what the answer. Now, I want to be fair. He said, I appreciate, sharing your thoughts with me, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. In other words,
I wanted to get back to you.
Yeah.
I did call. I called Senator Santorum's office here in the Pittsburgh area. I talked to the girl, and the girl said that she, and they did, They would contact Senator Santorum's office in Washington and mail me out and give me a response. And I wanted to call you and tell you that what that response was.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Gary. I appreciate it. It's incredible. I mean, it is another symptom of the just mind-boggling arrogance of Rick Santorum. He has to be one of the five worst senators in the United States Senate, and most destructive and most dangerous as well, in my opinion. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff. You're going to have to hang on over the break here. We're on a new schedule, and this is the first week of it, and twice now I've been caught by breaks I wasn't expecting. But it's great we have them. It is the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. 45 minutes past the hour.
democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Old man, look at my life. 24 and there's so much more. Live alone in a paradise that makes me think of two.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number here on Talk Radio for the rest of us. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, exposing the con in conservative Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. I got two comments. First of all, this Newsweek thing of people being afraid to tell Bush.
Yeah.
Well, why are they getting their information on this storm from the TV and such? Why aren't they? Don't they have agents down there? And why isn't Bush asking about it, first of all?
Well, because he has no curiosity whatsoever.
This is the question people need to be asking. Why is Bush not interested?
You're absolutely right. But in fact, it goes beyond that. This gets back to the point of the piece that I wrote for Common Dreams last week that you can find by going to tomhartman.com and clicking on Articles on Democracy, which is that if you don't believe in government, you're not going to competently govern.
Which brings up the point from, you had that guest who said collective self-interest. Well, the neurocons, which we're calling them now.
Yeah.
The neurocons don't believe in a collective self-interest. If you look at their thing, they blame the poor for being poor in New Orleans. Said, well, they need to lift themselves up, get them off the government's back. But they give no mechanism for the private sector to help them because they, Davis Bacon, you know, Bush is bypassing that. And also they're not raising the minimum wage.
Yeah.
So either way, they're screwing people. Yeah, they just simply don't believe in a collective self-interest.
Yeah, absolutely, and they don't believe in the commons, which is another way of saying that in some part, and they have bought into the Ayn Rand ideal, this bizarre notion that individual selfishness is the highest goal and that will solve all problems. And when look at biological systems, when a single agent in a biological system takes over. And, another selfishness rules, that's called cancer.
Yeah, they're bypassing nature's laws. They're bypassing Christian doctrine. They're bypassing the doctrine of every religion. It's it is cancer.
Yeah, a new and deadly one. And we have seen now what that cancer is doing to the United States. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Howard in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Howard.
Yes, Howard. Tom, it's good to listen to you, I'll tell you that. I've been waiting for a long time to talk to you. But anyways, what I called you about, a subject that you don't hear many people talk about, which is currency manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is by manipulating currencies, it puts other nations at an advantage over other countries when it comes to trade.
Right.
And are you aware of it?
Well, yeah. I mean, the Bush administration has been saying for some time, for several years now, that the reason why our jobs are going overseas, the reason why our economy is hemorrhaging, the reason why we have these huge trade imbalances is because the Chinese have been manipulating a currency, that they've been artificially pegging the yuan to the U.S. dollar, when in fact the value of the yuan should be less than the U.S. dollar.
But yes, but the thing about it is that if they're aware of it, then they should act on it because it's. Okay.
Well, there's nothing that you can do. I mean, you can't say to another country you have to change your currency, and really it's a straw man, because the reason why our trade problems are so bad has nothing to do with currency manipulation domestically or internationally. It has to do with lousy trade policy. It has to do with the fact that we gave up a tariff system in exchange for a system of international agreements that are negotiated by and mediated by multinational corporations. We have an international trade system now of, by, and for multinationals and not for nation states any longer. So it should surprise nobody that nation states are getting screwed.
You see, the thing is, Tom, that's one thing that's really hurting the American worker, and the other thing hurting the American worker big time is the Mexican border is wide open, and those jobs are being taken by the service economy is going to the Mexican workers.
Right, and that has nothing to do with the Mexican border being wide open, because the Mexican border has been wide open for 200 years, and we haven't been invaded by Mexico. What has happened since Ronald Reagan is that we have taken apart the first bulwark against illegal immigration, and that is organized labor. Organized labor historically was the canary in the mine shaft. They were the ones, or really the first layer of defense. They were the ones who said, hey, wait a minute, you can't work in this labor market because you're not a citizen of the United States. We're looking out for the working person here. Thank you very much. And so now, having taken us from 25% of our workforce being unionized when Reagan first came into office, to now where it's 8%, 8 to 9% of the private workforce in the United States, under Bush, we have so little of those protections that employers feel that they can hire illegal immigrants with impunity. If you want to stop the illegal immigration problem, see, this is not, it's not evil Mexicans and it's not incompetent border patrol. Yeah, I mean, you could build the biggest fence in the world and you still have 10% of Mexico living in the United States illegally right now. It's neither one of those. If you want to stop the illegal immigration problem, tomorrow morning, pass a law that says that the CEO of any company that hires even one illegal for even 1 week goes to prison for 1 year. If you were to do that, I guarantee you within 48 hours, well, probably it'll take a week or two, but within 2 weeks, you would have something like somewhere between 2 and 10 million people standing on the border between the United States and Mexico on the U.S. side, trying to get into the Mexican side, back to Mexico, because nobody would be willing to hire them. The only reason they're coming here is because people are giving them jobs.
Okay, Tom. It's a pleasure talking to you and listening to you.
Thank you very much, Howard.
I will continue to listen.
Okay, good. Thank you. I mean, this is the thing. It gets demagogued on the left. It gets demagogued on the right. People are saying, oh, it's a failure of the Border Patrol. I'm sorry. You know, yeah, the Border Patrol is overwhelmed. But why are they overwhelmed? Because there's demand for cheap labor here. And because the Bush administration keeps saying, oh, we're gonna legalize all you guys. Keep coming up here. That's what's wrong. It's not that you've got nasty Mexicans or other South Americans. It's not that you've got, you know, evil Border Patrol. No, it's that you've got corporations that want to maximize profit by having cheap labor, and to hell with the American labor force. That is the corporate bottom line. That is the conservative bottom line. And, you know, until we go back to a day where you have strong organized labor in this country and strong laws against hiring illegal immigrants, you're going to have the same problem. Everybody's missing it. It's so obvious. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.